Well, good morning. We're going to look at the conclusion of chapter 8 in our survey of Judges. This is lesson number 9, and I believe this is the longest title so far. We're going to hopefully cover the end of Gideon, Abimelech, Tola, Jair, and the interregnum in today's lesson. I hope to cover chapters 9 and 10. I'd like to finish these two chapters today, so we'll move right along this morning. When we last left our dear friends, the Israelites, and we had seen Gideon with the ephod that was a snare to Israel that caused all of Israel to go whoring after it. It was also part of the downfall of Gideon. It's a real blemish on Gideon's name to have made this. And we also remember that the purpose of this ephod, there are lots of details that are left out of the narrative in terms of how Israel used it and what happened, and there's been a great body of literature written on, well, relatively speaking, on what happened and what are the characteristics of the Israelites. But what we want to emphasize is the point that God brings to them, and that they were not worshiping Him as He had commanded them to worship. They were not doing what He had authorized them to do. And we can see this because throughout the book, oftentimes they have not completely forgotten Jehovah, but instead have mixed worship in some sort of syncretistic fashion. And God says that it's an abomination and that they have forsaken Me. Now the language, the rhetoric will heat just a bit for Tola, Jael, and the interregnum in this period, and we'll look at that toward the end of the class. But for now, let's finish up chapter 8, and we'll start in verse 28. Thus Midian was subdued before the children of Israel, so that they lifted their heads no more, and the country was quiet for 40 years in the days of Gideon. Then Jerubbabel, the son of Joash, went and dwelt in his own house. Gideon had 70 sons who were his own offspring, for he had many wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, whose name he called Abimelech. Now Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a good old age and was buried in the tomb of Joash, his father, in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. So it was, as soon as Gideon was dead, that the children of Israel once again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. Thus the children of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side. Nor did they show kindness to the house of Jerubbabel, Gideon, in accordance with the good he had done for Israel. Boy, you get the picture that this is one ungrateful lot when you see how they have treated him. And that last section there on the lack of Israel remembering the goodness of Gideon and what he had done for them will come into play in the next chapter. But there are some remarkable statements made in here. Gideon finished his days in his own house, ruling Israel for 40 years. And the fact that it is mentioned in verse 29 that he dwelt in his own house is simply remarkable in the annals of history. Rarely does a civil magistrate who achieves the level of power and influence and victory, such as Gideon, go back to live in his own house when the job is done. Usually these men who are who achieve this level, which there have been plenty, leave high office by death. They do not leave high office on their own. Very, very few have done so. And, you know, men like George Washington and the Roman combination general and dictator Cincinnatus come to mind as two leaders who performed their public duties and then went back to their own house. He was obviously in a economic condition had changed rather remarkably from living in the dens and caves in this 40-year period, that he could now afford multiple homes in different locations and maintain households combining 70 children for a guy who was trying to hide his grain so that the Midianites didn't find it, to maintaining households comprising 70 children, 70 sons anyway. The conditions must have changed rather remarkably. Now, only one of Gideon's sons is named in this passage, and it is a bit of an odd name. The name means my king, my father is king, or something close to this, my father the king, or something along these lines. It may not have been his actual given name, but rather a name he assumed, or something that was given to him later in life, perhaps a cognomen. But it is also a name or a title associated with Canaanite kings, which is important to understand. Earlier we read that Gideon refused the office of king when it was offered to him, and he also declined it on behalf of his children. He said, Neither myself, nor will my sons rule over you, but the Lord will rule over you. But it could very well have been the case that Gideon had such a presence in ruling Israel that he was a de facto king. He could have been the type of judge that was above all other judges in terms of his presence and his power. We don't really know for sure. I think the debate is open. In either case, his son certainly thought that his dad was king, but it could also be that his son simply assumed the name for himself and Gideon did not. Having many wives is another indicator that he considered himself to be in a ruling class. It was the habit of many kings to do this. God intended the design to be one man and one woman, regardless of whatever cultural norms might be in place at the time. And here we find another example of why the scriptures are so, they stand above all other pieces of literature. And when you read secular history and the history of their rulers and kings, rarely do you find warts and blemishes. But Scripture does not give us the opinion that the greatest of men were sin-free. They paint them with all their warts and blemishes, and they're there for us to see that all of men are fallen. And we see that Gideon was a man who was just like everybody else. He had his shortcomings and he had his problems. The Scriptures give us the truth. Well, at Gideon's death, we find again the children of Israel have forgotten everything that they've learned. They forgot the goodness of God in raising Gideon, the impoverishment they had previously suffered at the hands of the Midianites, and most importantly, they had forgotten God himself. They were a people who were prone to forget. It's a good thing, however, that God did not forget them. So let's look at Gideon's sons in chapter 9, and I'll read small portions of this and make comments on it, and we'll work our way through this chapter. If you're unfamiliar with what we're about to read, it is a story full of despair to see this son of Gideon and what he attempts to pull off for himself. And Matthew Henry, before I even read this section, I wanted to read this comment that I think is the best summary that I've ever read on this chapter. He said, "The apostasy of Israel after the death of Gideon is punished, not as former apostasies by a foreign invasion or the oppressions of any neighboring power, but by intestine broils among themselves, which in this chapter we have the story of. And it is hard to say whether their sin or their misery appears most in it." I think it's very well put. As you discover what's in this chapter, you can see Israel is under oppression, but from within this time. It is as bleak as any account in the book of Judges. So let's start in verse 1. "Then Abimelech, the son of Zerubbabel, went to Shechem, to his mother's brothers, and spoke with them, and with all the family, the house of his mother's father, saying, 'Please speak in the hearing of all the men of Shechem. Which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Zerubbabel reign over you, or that one reign over you? Remember that I am your own flesh and bone.' And his mother's brothers spoke all these words concerning him in the hearing of all the men of Shechem. And their heart was inclined to follow Abimelech, for he said, 'He is our brother.' So they gave him 70 shekels of silver from the temple of Baal Berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless men, and they followed him. Then he went to his father's house at Ophrah, and killed his brothers, the 70 sons of Zerubbabel, on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Zerubbabel, was left because he hid himself. And all the men of Shechem gathered together, all of Beth Milo, and they went and made Abimelech king beside the terebinth tree at the pillar that was in Shechem." Some commentators have noticed or opined that that this mother, this woman of Shechem, was a this handmaid was a who was a concubine was a Canaanite. Well, I mean, it's certainly possible, given what we see in this chapter, that she was a Canaanite. It's a little hard to reconcile what Gideon was doing in Shechem with a Canaanite woman as a handmaid. There were, from what I could tell, an endless array of linguistic concerns as to how this word should be thought of in this sense or that. And I don't really know for sure. The scriptures don't make it painfully clear, but I think it's a reasonable conjecture. But whether she was or not, the men and the people of Shechem prove themselves to be worthless. And their acts that are detailed in this account will show us their real mettle. Abimelech gathers whatever household constituency makes up that side of the family, and he makes a proposal to these folks, and he says, "Do you want one king among you, or do you want many among you?" Many kings. Well, you would think even a first-year logic student should be able to observe the shortcoming of the offer that was made. It was a false dilemma. The option was not one king versus many, but how about the real choice being the elders that they had in God ruling over them, and no one king over them all. But after his appointment and convincing the men of Shechem that he ought to be appointed to the throne, the Shechemites gave him 70 pieces of silver from the temple treasury. And I think the connection is reasonable enough that this was the blood money paid to go kill the rest of the sons of Gideon, the rest of his brothers. 70 shekels, and there were 70 sons, so assumingly they paid him in a round number, and he used the money to go hire some men to do this. Shechem is a city. It's located right here in red. Shechem is a city in an area that occupies a long portion of the biblical narrative. Abraham and Jacob both visited this place. The rape of Jacob's daughter Dinah took place there. Now whether the current citizens of Shechem were the same ones as those who abused Dinah is unknown, but I think it's a reasonable assumption. It's also, I think, reasonable to say that the majority of the people there were not Israelites. The money that the Shechemites gave Abimelech was from the temple of Baal, and it was not Jehovah's temple. This money was used to hire the vain men that were mentioned to do the bidding of Abimelech so they could go slay his brothers. And this all took place back in Ophrah, back in Gideon's home. And we're not quite sure exactly what happened, but it appears that they were all slain on this stone, on a stone, it said, and it would seem that they were all executed upon this stone. This is the whole purpose of it, is bringing them together to execute them. Abimelech, in this case, is acting as if he were the judge, and these men were criminally guilty against the state, and it's his duty to oppose them and to depose of them. One person, one son, escaped the massacre, and that was Jotham, and he shows himself to be a very wise son of Gideon. So let's pick it back up in verse 7. "Now when they told Jotham, he went and stood on top of Mount Gerizim, and lifted his voice and cried out, and he said to them, 'Listen to me, you men of Shechem, that God may listen to you. The trees once went forth to appoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, "Reign over us." But the olive tree said to them, "Should I cease giving my oil with which they honor God and men and go to sway over other trees?" Then the tree said to the fig tree, "You come and reign over us." But the fig tree said to them, "Should I cease my sweetness and my good fruit and go to sway over trees?" Then the tree said to the vine, "You come and reign over us." But the vine said to them, "Should I cease my new wine which cheers both God and man and go sway over trees?" Then all the trees said to the bramble, "You come and reign over us." And the bramble said to the trees, "If in truth you anoint me as king over you, then come and take shelter in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. Now therefore, if you have acted in truth and sincerity in making Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Zerubbabel and his house, and have done to him as he deserves, for my father fought for you, risked his life, and delivered you out of the hand of Midian, But you have risen up against my father's house this day, and killed his 70 sons on one stone, and made Abimelech, the son of his female servant, king over the men of Shechem, because he is your brother. If then you have acted in truth and sincerity with Jerubbabel, and with his house this day, then rejoice in Abimelech, and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and Beth Milo, and let fire come from the men of Shechem and Beth Milo and devour Abimelech. And Joshua ran away and fled, and he went to Beer and dwelt there for fear of Abimelech his brother. Well, it's quite a story that he is telling them, and it's interesting. Jotham proceeds to Mount Gerizim, which is just here to the southwest of Shechem. So it was a close place and has a strategic point in history. And he delivers a fable unto them. Fawcett makes the observation, and I couldn't think of any other instance, that this may be the oldest known fable in literature, is Jotham's fable here in Judges 9. Gerizim was that mountain where the blessings of God were proclaimed to the people, and Mount Ebal was where the curses were proclaimed, and Mount Ebal is just right over here. So there's no mistaking the symbolism here. Jotham is on Mount Gerizim, and he's making a claim to them that they need to come to repentance to receive the blessing of God. He urges them, listen to me that God may listen to you. There is, there's no sense given in the scripture that the other sons of Gideon were as wicked as Abimelech was. And you see a strong contrast between Jotham and Abimelech. His words are clear, and they are stinging, and they are strong. Okay, in the fable, we see the trees seeking a king. They approach the olive, the fig, and then some vines to see if they will reign over them. And all the characters so far refuse this request and are depicted as noble and upright. They will have nothing to do with this uproar from Shechem. However, and it's beautiful the way he composed this, when we get to the bramble is altogether too happy to comply with their request. He is so eager to do so that he grossly exaggerates all of his abilities. And I think the significance in this fable for the character development is in the bramble most of all. Gideon also used bramble to inflict punishment on the men of Succoth. And I suspect that this was something that was in the minds of the people of that day, being part of the lore of the wars. So full of his own regard, the bramble that is, that he says if you'll not take comfort in his shade, then you need to be prepared for the consequences, the fire that's going to come out. Now, I've never observed anything taking comfort in the shade of bramble. Bramble's not big enough to offer shade to anybody. Even the vines, which would have had a limited stature, were at least smart enough not to make claims outside of that which they could not fill. So after he finishes with the fable, Jotham puts the case to the assembly, to the men that are gathered together there in the form of a question. And the essence of which is whether or not Gideon and his family deserve to be mercilessly slaughtered, and should someone who was the son of a handmaid, in other words, not a true heir, be put on a throne. And he says, if you've done all these things well, then by all means rejoice in Abimelech. If Gideon deserved it, if his sons deserved it, if Israel deserves better than what they had under Gideon and that remembrance, then by all means use Abimelech. But he finishes this exhortation to them with a small but significant prophecy. He says, let fire come from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and Beth Milo, and let fire come from the men of Shechem and Beth Milo and devour Abimelech. So he gives them a choice. If all these things are true, then rejoice. You've got nothing to worry about. However, if they're not, well then serious consequences will come. Jotham then flees to Beer, which is outside, apparently, of Abimelech's jurisdiction. We don't really know where this city is, but I'm sure it was quite some distance away. Let's pick it up again in verse 22. After Abimelech had reigned over Israel 3 years, God sent a spirit of ill will between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, and the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech, that the crime done to the 70 sons of Jerubbabel might be settled, and their blood be laid on Abimelech, their brother. who killed them, and on the men of Shechem, who aided in the killing of his brothers. Well, these 3 years, I suspect, seemed like an awfully long time to many folks, but it was not so long a time that God would forget all the treachery done to the house of Gideon. The men of Shechem are mentioned as being just as guilty as Abimelech was, for they had provided the money and the manpower for Abimelech to consolidate his power and establish his throne. It's interesting, conspiracies are an interesting phenomenon. Men love to believe that they can close the loop and insulate themselves against recrimination. So they get together and said, what do we need to do to make Abimelech king? Well, we need to vote him in, and then we need to make sure that none of his brothers have a rival claim that could be sustained. So let's give him the money out of the temple, and let's go kill the brothers. Well, the problem with conspiracies is that there's always one more party involved than the two who are direct, and that's God himself, who saw all of this going on and was going to have not going to bless this endeavor in any way. And it's said here, the writer makes a very clear point, that God is going to repay the men of Shechem for their conspiracy with Abimelech to kill the house of Gideon. So there is no conspiracy that men can form whereby they are allowed to sin with impunity. And God has Abimelech on a leash, and it's finally run its length. The days are numbered of the house of Abimelech. Only a fool would have trusted in such a scoundrel as he was. All right, we've got a quote here from Matthew Henry again that was thought was helpful. Accessories shall be reckoned with as well as principles in that and other sins. The Shechemites that countenanced Abimelech's pretensions aided and abetted him in his bloody project and avowed the fact by making him king after it was done. They must fall with him and fall by him, and they shall fall first. Those that combine together to do wickedly are justly dashed in pieces against one another. Blood cannot be a lasting cement to any interest. Another one of those famous Henry pithy sayings, that blood is terrible cement for these relationships. All right, verse 25. And the men of Shechem set in ambush against him on the tops of the mountains, and they robbed all who passed by them along the way, and it was told Abimelech. So if you look at the geography here, can you see that this whole place is mountainous? If you ever want to come up and look a little closer at this map, there are just mountains everywhere and hills. I mean, not rocky mountains, but they're elevations, and people would be traveling through the land. And you can remember back in the days of Shamgar, the people were dispirited because the Philistines had come and taken the travelers and had abused them and robbed and killed various travelers, and God raised up a deliverer. Well, here the men of Shechem are employing a similar technique to make all the people distrust in Abimelech. They've had their hearts turned on him, and they want to remove him from the throne. He's still got enough power that they can't do so. So they decide, rather than attacking him directly, they'll disguise themselves, go out into the hills and the highways and byways, and rob everybody, and they'll claim that what's the good of having a king like Abimelech if he can't protect us as we go in and we go out. All right, verse 26. Now Gaal, the son of Ebed, came with his brothers and went over to Shechem, and the men of Shechem put their confidence in him. So they went out into the fields and gathered grapes from their vineyards and trod them and made merry. And they went into the house of their god and ate and drank and cursed Abimelech. Then Gaal, the son of Ebed, said, "Who is Abimelech and who is Shechem that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Zerubbabel, and is not Zebul his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem. But why should we serve him? If only this people were under my authority, then I would remove Abimelech." So he said to Abimelech, "Increase your army and come out." Well, of this Gaal fellow, we know nothing other than this account, what this account offers, but the commentator Fawcett made this speculation that he was probably a roving Shechemite captain of freebooters, which is probably as good a description as you could get. It would appear that he had ambitions of a regality in the abundance of brothers, and an abundance of brothers who shared his thoughts. So in many ways, he's no different than Abimelech. He wasn't interested in serving the people of Shechem, only interested in securing a kingship for himself. He was probably a Canaanite as well. His appeal to the men of Shechem is on the basis of Hamor, the father of Shechem, and not on Jehovah or anything related to Israel. So his claim to the throne is nothing more than what will please him and help him in their local loyalties. What is particularly revealing in this account is the idolatry of the men and how they seemingly possess no fear of God. There's no mention of God in this particular section on what they're doing might be wrong. Here, the men of Shechem, they plot murder and unrest without the slightest bit of concern. You know, this ought to make everybody stop for just a minute and wonder how a whole people could be given to such bloodshed. It didn't seem to bother them to go kill the 70 sons of Gideon. And now we have another man, Gaal, with his brothers in alliance, come and, well, we need to go kill other people. Bloodshed is a way of life for these people. Now, the reason I say it ought to give us all concern is the reason they are like this is that God sent the Spirit to stir up their baser instincts, and He wasn't acting contrary to their will. This is exactly the kind of thing they would want to do anyway, but were restrained in at other times. And I think it's a haunting prospect for God to send a Spirit against a group of people to stir them up to act according to their nature, that they might destroy themselves. I ought to give everyone a little pause for concern. Well, then let's look at verse 30 and move this through. When Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, the son of Ebed, his anger was aroused. And he sent messengers to Abimelech secretly saying, "Take note, Gaal, the son of Ebed, and his brothers have come to Shechem, and here they are, fortifying the city against you. Now therefore, get up by night, you and the people who are with you, and lie in wait in the field. And it shall be as soon as the sun is up in the morning that you shall rise early and rush upon the city. And when he and the people who are with him come out against you may do to them as you find opportunity." So Abimelech and all the people who were with him rose by night and lay in wait against Shechem in four companies. When Gaal, the son of Ebed, went out and stood in the entrance of the city gate, Abimelech and the people who were with him rose from lying in wait. When Gaal saw the people, he said to Zebul, "Look, people are coming down from the tops of the mountains." Zebul said to him, "You see the shadows of the mountains as if they were men." So Gaal spoke again and said, "See, people are coming down from the center of the land, and another company is coming from the diviner's terebinth tree." Then Zebul said to him, "Where indeed is your mouth now, with which you said, 'Who is Abimelech that we should serve him?' Are not these people whom you despised? Go out, if you will, and fight with them now." Well, pretty clever on behalf of Zebul. I don't know for sure if he was necessarily a loyal subject to Abimelech. He did have his anger aroused when Gaal spoke evil of Abimelech. But accordingly, it could be that he just disliked Gaal as much as he disliked anybody else coming into his city and telling him what to do. But he spills Gaul's plan to the men of Abimelech and says, "This is what you need to do to overtake this character." It also struck me as interesting that when everyone around you has formed conspiracies, who are you to trust? All the characters in this narrative are all forming a conspiracy with one or more parties. And who's a guy to trust in a situation like that? When Gaal suspects trouble, and I think this is just precious, when he says, "There's people out there, I can see them, there are people in the mountains coming down." "No, there aren't. You see shadows in the mountains that appear like people." And some time, doesn't tell us how long, elapsed. And "No, I'm pretty sure those are people coming down in the mountains coming to get me." He said, "All right, put your money where your mouth is, big boy, and get out there and fight them like you promised us." So, verse 39. So Gaal went out, leading the men of Shechem, and fought with Abimelech. And Abimelech chased him, and he fled from him. And many fell wounded to the very entrance of the gate. Then Abimelech dwelt at Aruma, and Zebul drove out Gaal and his brothers so that they would not dwell in Shechem. And it came about on the next day that the people went out into the field, and they told Abimelech. So he told his people, divided them into three companies, and lay in wait in the field. And he looked, and there were the people coming out of the city. And he rose against them and attacked them. Then Abimelech and the company that was with him rushed forward and stood at the entrance of the gate of the city. So the other two companies rushed upon all who were in the fields and killed them. So Abimelech fought against the city all that day. He took the city and killed the people who were in it and demolished the city and sowed it with salt. Well, you've got Abimelech, Zebul, and their men are able to kill or expel Gaal and the other rebels, but Abimelech here divides his men up into companies, as his father would do, and he must have been paying somewhat of attention to what was happening in history. But then he decides he's going to attack Shechem, and the Shechemites thought life was be restored back to normal. Normal being Abimelech's kingship, because after Gaal's departure and they've run him out of town, they decided to go back to the fields and do whatever they had wanted to do. Fawcett makes this comment about the Shechemites being restored to their life being restored to normal. He said, "The Shechemites, with the characteristic fickleness of the multitude, soon repented of their choice." That is, selecting Gaal. It had been better if they had repented from their sins. You see, they've only gone from one bad situation to another equally poor situation. Now, it would appear from the narrative that Abimelech believes that the inhabitants of the city are just as responsible for the uprising as was Gaal. His men exact vicious revenge on the inhabitants who probably thought the worst had been over, for they had gone back out in verse 27 and originally had gone back out to harvest the grapes. So they're probably going back out after the battles to see that that life was normal again, and it's not normal. Abimelech and his men are waiting in the fields. Abimelech sowed the city with salt that it might be desolate forever. It would be a monument to him that no one should oppose Abimelech. Well, eventually the city was rebuilt, and Israel went there to crown Rehoboam king. We find this in 1 Kings 12:1 that the city of Shechem was to be the place to crown him. Let's look at verse 46. Now, when all the men of the tower of Shechem had heard that, they entered the stronghold of the temple of the god Berith, and it was told Abimelech that all the men of the tower of Shechem were gathered together. Then Abimelech went up to Mount Zalmon, and he and the people who were with him. And Abimelech took an ass in his hand and cut down a bough from the trees, and took it and laid it on his shoulder. Then he said to the people who were with him, "What you have seen me do, make haste and do as I have done." So each of the people likewise cut down from his own bow and followed Abimelech, put them against the stronghold, and set the stronghold on fire above them, so that all the people of the tower of Shechem died, about 1,000 men and women. This Berith god is mentioned in Judges 8:33 and in 9:4. In the end of chapter 8, we read the conclusion that Israel went to serve Baal, and it would appear that this is the god, at least in this section, that they wanted to serve. The men of Shechem decided that with everybody dying in the fields, they had better get into this tower that they had erected for themselves for safety. And the compiler of Judges makes the note that they went into the temple, the stronghold. This was the stronghold of the temple of their god Berith. And Abimelech is hot in pursuit. He's got an axe in hand, and he decides to cut some branches down and tells his men to do the same. They set the tower on fire, and they kill 1,000 people. It had to be an impressive tower or some sort of castle or stronghold to hold 1,000 people securely and have it all burned to the ground. It would appear that Berith was not the god of water, but more of your fire types, because the god of the temple was unable to deliver them from the hands of Abimelech. And Abimelech, you can see, is intent on the wholesale destruction of these people because of their treason and seducing Gaal to be their king. During all of these events, God, however, is using the wrath of Abimelech to punish the men of Shechem who aided and abetted him during the slaughter of the good men of Gideon's house. You've got to remember, in the opening of this chapter, it was the spirit that God had sent to them to sow discord between them. And in so doing, he's bringing vengeance on the men of Shechem through this abominable Abimelech. Some think that the men of the Tower of Shechem were the same that were the house of Milo, which is mentioned earlier, and that Jotham's just imprecation was answered in the letter. Let fire come out from Abimelech and devour not only in general the men of Shechem, but in particular the house of Milo. So some see this as the first part of that prophecy being fulfilled, that fire came out from the bramble and devoured these people. It's possible. Verse 50. Then Abimelech went to Thebes, and he encamped against Thebes and took it. But there was a strong tower in the city, and all the men and women, all the people of the city, fled there and shut themselves in. They went to the top of the tower. So Abimelech came as far as the tower and fought against it. And he drew near the door of the tower to burn it with fire. But a certain woman dropped an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. Then he called quickly to the young man, his armor bearer, and said to him, "Draw your sword and kill me, lest men say of me, 'A woman killed him.'" So his young men thrust him through, and he died. And when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, they departed, every man to his place. For reasons unknown, that Abimelech travels to Thebes to destroy the men there. And the people here flee to their tower of safety, just as the Shechemites did. And in the mind of Abimelech, the circumstances are identical, and he sees success on the horizon. One tower down, one tower to go. Well, it appears that this tower would be constructed out of material which wouldn't burn as easily, because the men attempt to burn the door here first. And as usual, Abimelech, being a good leader, decides that he's going to lead the charge and put the wood down there by the door. But unfortunately, this became his undoing, because a certain woman dropped a upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. Now, it's really odd how men think during important times in their life. And he realizes he's going to die, and he doesn't want this to be at the hand of a woman. So he instructs one of his men to murder him. Now, this is the second time in the book of Judges that a woman has freed Israel from the oppression of an enemy. Abimelech's dying thoughts and his words show only a concern for his legacy. There's no mention of his regret for the fratricide, nor for the slaughter of Shechem, but only let me die honorably. Well, in case any of you are wondering, I'd say a woman was the one who done him in. I don't think he died honorably at all. Well, there have been some poetic justice, if you will, in the life of Abimelech, that others have suggested that here he was killed by a stone, and he had killed all of his brethren on a stone, and there was God was repaying him. It was also killed by a woman, and it was a woman, more likely his mother, who put these visions of grandeur in his head. This incident of Abimelech being killed was well known throughout the history of Israel. In 2 Samuel 11, 18 to 21, Joab mentions this incident when he has Uriah killed. And if you recall, that's how he had Uriah killed. He had everybody get up close and the other people withdraw so that someone could kill him from close up. And the Joab tells the messenger, when David blows his cover here and says, "Why in the world are you guys, why'd you get so close to the tower?" And he mentions the story. You tell him that Uriah was the one that died. That which was said of Boniface the VIII could be applied justly to Abimelech. He came like a fox, ruled like a lion, died like a dog. Verse 56, then God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father by killing his 70 brothers, and all the evil of the men of Shechem God returned on their own heads, and on them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal. Not a word of the Lord will fail to come to pass. All right, I've got some new artwork. I do want to cover the next two judges ever so briefly, but I have to introduce this. It's not in chronological order. I found some things earlier on relating to Judges. So here we have the death of Abimelech at Thebes in two different depictions, and for some reason some guy decided that he'd put his picture down in the bottom left-hand corner of this. It all looks so terribly unrealistic, but all the men here are cowering in fear, and this woman picks up a millstone that looks about half her body weight and is able to throw it over. Then this second woodcut is from the Benjaminites taking wives, and they have that forlorn look like, "Oh no, not you," much as women today when they find a husband. And here you see another woodcut of Jael killing Sisera, and he's pulling upside, and she shows him hiding under the curtain there. Here are a couple of Gustave Doré's Death of the Sons of Gideon up on the rock, and then the death of Abimelech. And you can see his Abimelech reaching up there and looking all pitiful and such. I found another copy of the woodcut of this woman who's unnaturally strong, and I found a reversal of it as well. I thought it was interesting and put it in there. But best of all, there is a tour you can take, I think from a college in Walla Walla. I think it's some sort of woman's thing. I think that's the college. There's a woman pastor who's overseeing this. This is the third seasonal millstone toss from the Walla Walla College. And so, this character, I don't know who it is, a man or a woman here. Abimelech is being drawn on a watermelon by artist Rhonda Root, so I guess it's a woman. And here the women gather on this little tower, and Abimelech's nemesis, Arika Hufnagel, whose second try nailed him, and then you can see Abimelech's demise gruesomely portrayed as they were able to smash the watermelon. I think it took them quite some time to pull that off. Now there's a reenactment story for you. Here's another copy of Abimelech dying at the Tower of Thebes from an older print. And here you can see Abimelech looking out in the fields and Zebul behind him saying, no, those are all shadows. The detail is not quite as good on that one. This is I thought it was a better imprint of this unnaturally strong woman here with these cowardly men biting their nails. So you can see how they're ready to fight. And then there's one last one here, Abimelech slain by his armor bearer, and he just looks pitiful there. His brains aren't all gushed out, which you would have hoped to have seen, and his sword is a bit bent, his armor bearer's sword, so... Okay, I'm going to start chapter 10 and cover a little bit. We'll not get to the interregnum today, but I want to discuss a few other things on the board here. Chapter 10, verse 1. After Abimelech, there arose to save Israel Tola, the son of Pua, the son of Dodo, a man of Issachar, and he dwelt in Shamir in the mountains of Ephraim. He judged Israel for 23 years, and he died and was buried in Shamir. Tola is the only judge where both his father and grandfather are mentioned, and he appears to be a man of Issachar, which would have been to the this section right up here, and we don't know exactly where this Shamar is, but Issachar put into the Ephraimite country where he was a ruler, so he came down instead of ruling from up there, went to a more central location. And then you have the seventh judge, Jair, in verses 3 through 5. After him, that is Tola, arose Jair, a Gileadite, and he judged Israel 22 years. Now he had 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys, and they also had 30 towns, which are called Havoth-Jair to this day, which are in the hand of Gilead. And Jair died and was buried in Cammon. If there ever was a judge who successfully employed his sons, it may have been so with Jair. The mention of the 30 sons, the donkeys, and the cities probably give us some reason to believe that these men helped keep order throughout all of Israel. So there's a very positive depiction in contrast with Gideon's 70 sons who never either had the opportunity or were prohibited from doing so. Lang's commentary... a fellow named Cassell wrote this section. He cites somebody, I'm not sure who, by this comment regarding jail. The removal of hardened sinners by a righteous God often makes for reformation and public tranquility and proves a great mercy to those who survive. So when we look at these last two judges, Tola and Jair, they come on the heels of the men of Shechem and this section of Israel being destroyed. And how often it is the case that God brings peace to his people by the removal of the wicked, removal of those who are causing Israel to sin. All right, we're not going to get to the rest of chapter 10. And those cities that are mentioned, we really don't know where they're at. Some think they are, Shamir was here and another place up here on the coast, but we really don't know. So what I'd like to do is talk for just a minute. I'd like to mention this compact table of judges. If you'll recall that one of the goals that I had in this class is I do think there is a tendency among people in listening to the book of Judges to see nothing but the misery and the lack of faithfulness of Israel. And I think that's the wrong focus to have. What you see is God's goodness in bringing His people to repentance again and again and again. He punishes them cruelly, but He does so to bring them to repentance. In fact, this period called the interregnum is about the best there is, I think, in the book of Judges to describe that. And it's unfortunate we're not going to have time to do that today. But if you read the book of Judges and you see the warts and the blemishes of Gideon and of this judge and the weakness of Barak and whatever you're looking at all the wrong things. If you say Gideon would not go forth until he had this fleece, well, what you see is God confirming faith in Gideon. People like Barak, people like Gideon are all mentioned in Hebrews 11 as people of faith. And you see God coming again and again and again to the rescue of His people, bringing them to repentance when they have acted waywardly. And in nearly every instance, it's not social justice, it's not the oppression of the poor, it is regard to worship, that God is very jealous for His worship. And time and again, the people fail to serve God. They don't fail to serve God in that sense that they utterly forsook Him, that there was no remembrance of Him. But they fail to worship Him as He has told them to worship. They have failed to follow Him with their whole heart. And God says, I won't have it. That is forsaking Me. That is serving the Baals. If you're not going to do what I said, it's serving the other men. And you can see, and I think this 301 number is the number I want you to get to. And we'll start at the top and work your way down here. But you have the judges, Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah and Barak, Gideon. Abimelech is listed in the chronology, but not as a judge, Tola and Jer. Sometimes people were sold, sometimes the enemy's hands were strengthened, sometimes they were delivered. Sometimes we read how the Spirit of the Lord was upon a judge. Sometimes it's not. We see that there are various tribes, Judah, Benjamin, Manasseh, Issachar, and Gilead. It's Cushan, Rishathaim, Moabites, Philistines, Jabesh and the Canaanites, Midians. We have unknown oppressors during these times. Over here, and this is an important column, you see the periods of rest under the judges, another 40 years, 80 years, 40, 40, 23, and 22. We have 245 years of rest in the land of Israel. You have years of servitude, 8 and 18, 20, 7, 3, if you count the years of servitude under Abimelech and none other, for a total of 56 years there. But you look at the total elapsed years from this chronology, you're at 301 years, 245 of which are years spent in faithfully serving the Lord, where there was a judge, a ruler in the land who had helped them. That's a long time. That's a very long time when you look at comparing, say, the last time since World War II, if you'll count that as troublesome times, versus 1707, something like that. If this country would have been blessed to have godly leadership, except from a combined total of, say, the end of World War II to now, you'd get a picture for the kind of history that we're referring to, and why the chronology of Judges is, I think, more important than is often given notice. The book is not about Israel's repeated faithlessness and their shortcomings. The book is about God's goodness in preserving His people, confirming their faith and delivering them from idolatry time and time again while their hearts are encouraged to follow those idols. All right, I've made my case. I hoped we'd get a little further, but we'll pick it up in verse 6 of chapter 10 next week, starting with the interregnum, and move from there. Be happy to take a couple of questions. Mr. Spittler.
Dave, I was wondering, you know, these two women both crush the heads of the oppressors. I'm wondering if any of the commentators commented on the seed of the woman crushing the head of the serpent.
Oh, that's a very good imagery. I hadn't thought of it. For the sake of the tape, question was asked whether the commentators have made any connections between the seed of the woman crushing the head and the two women that killed the enemies of Israel. That's a very good point. There is a lot of There's a lot of symbolism in the book of Judges. I'm not bringing all of it out. I'm not given to that sort of thing, finding it, that is. But there is a fair number of it. That's a good point. Any other thoughts or comments? Rebuttals? Distinctions? Wow, what a tame bunch. I thought surely the pictures would incite some comments. Let's pray.